from St. Louis Public Radio. This is the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. I'm Jason Rosenbaum. It's been about a year since Governor Mike Kehoe selected Jessica Bax as the director of the Department of Social Services. And to call the agency important and challenging would be an understatement. Bax is in charge of overseeing Missouri's Medicaid program, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, and the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families Program, or TANF. Her agency also includes Missouri's Children's Division, which manages the state's foster care system and investigates suspected child abuse and neglect. Bax says that she was well prepared to lead the huge agency, especially after she served in key roles in other Missouri state departments.
You have to have the mindset that behind every decision that you make is a child, a real person in Missouri. And how does that affect them? How does that ultimately impact the programs in a positive way?
But the long-term challenges before Bax are difficult even for the most seasoned state employee. That's especially the case after Congress passed what's known as the Big Beautiful Bill that enacted seismic changes to social services programs. A little later in the show, we'll hear her thoughts on the future of Missouri's Children's Division. But Bax and I first discussed how the Big Beautiful Bill affects Medicaid, the healthcare program for low-income, elderly, and disabled Missourians. That comes after Missouri's longtime Medicaid director, Todd Richardson, left his post late last year. Josh Moore is now in that role. I talked with Jessica Bax in her office in Jefferson City earlier this week.
So the changes that I was alluding to earlier are kind of on two prongs. The first is the implementation of work requirements. And I think they have to actually be in place by the end of this year unless the state gets a waiver. Is that correct before I ask
You're
my question?
Correct.
Okay. I think there's a lot of questions about whether states have the infrastructure or technological backbone to actually implement an oversight system to see if somebody is following the work requirements that are laid out in the One Big Beautiful Bill. When I was talking with Todd Richardson last year, he seemed pretty confident that the state would be able to do that. Are you also confident that you're going to be able to actually roll these out, roll these work requirements out by January 2027?
I'm confident that we are. There's a couple of things that we were already working towards in terms of, and so just kind of, to kind of level set, you said it's a very large, complicated agency. This is a great example of that because Todd Richardson, Josh Moore, Medicaid director, Medicaid eligibility falls within our family support division. So the implementation of work requirements and all of the technology with it is really within our family support division. So one of the things that I knew coming into the agency and understanding, getting a deeper understanding than I had even working with the agency over the past, but was that the technology needs for Medicaid were really, really needed a lot of support. So we brought in a Department of Social Services CIO, and she has really been looking at, from the beginning, Family Support Division as her kind of number one priority. And that even increased more with HR1 because we knew we had to streamline and get more automated. And work requirements is, at its core level, income verification, income and hours. And so that's really the path that we were already on with technology. She's looked at the states that have done it successfully and the states that have failed, and kind of what lessons did we learn from them and the challenges that they had. And so I think we have a really good positive path.
One of the things that Richardson talked about that actually seemed pretty innovative and potentially exciting was the possibility for the state to determine somebody's work requirement eligibility or income verification without them actually having to do anything. through like payroll records or something like that. And there was a lot of criticism of the work requirements from people kind of on the left end of the spectrum, because they saw it as kind of a paperwork trap that would kick people off of Medicaid that were entitled to it. But that sort of way of verifying income kind of solves that problem. So my question is that going to be the way that this happens? Because if it is, it could be very seamless and painless for people who are already on Medicaid.
Yeah. So Todd was correct. The path that we're working on is an automated, for as many people as possible, an automation of those requirements, where we are able to verify through our data sources. We kind of have a, not to get too nerdy, but a waterfall of verification sources
or
that
we go through.
Our
cornucopia of data services.
you check this one first and this one. We start with the free sources, and then we move on to the paid sources of information. And I think that's really where we may only need to verify if someone perhaps has multiple jobs, is doing work for cash, is doing maybe gig work. Those are the types of things where we've also, though, brought in a solution through our partners at SteadyIQ. And that has been a really great relationship. We're working with them on on the path for work requirements within their platform as well, to make sure that we're ready for individuals who maybe don't have a 40-hour a week job, or they have multiple jobs, and they need a solution in that more suits them.
The other thing that's on the horizon is the whole concept of Medicaid funding. And there's a couple of different ways we can go here. The first is from, again, talking with Todd Richardson, the money that the state got from the federal government from the American Rescue Plan that essentially gave the state, I guess, $1 or $2 billion for expanding Medicaid during that period of time, I think is going to run out in the next couple of years. And the state is going to have to find money for the state match, which I'm not sure how much it is, but my guess would be between $200 and $300 million a year, maybe more. How many more years does Missouri have until they reach that point where they're going to have to not rely on that money anymore?
I think that we're reaching that point within the next 2 years. And so that's something that we've had candid conversations about. And I think that the other piece of that is just in general, the growth of the Medicaid program is really something that we're looking at from a healthcare management perspective. And how does Missouri move towards a structure where we are helping people have good health outcomes and lowering our overall healthcare cost for the program while sustaining it for those who qualify?
And one of the things that I guess is better news in terms of money is that another part of the Big Beautiful Bill is the Rural Healthcare Transformation Plan. Missouri recently got awarded $260 million. That's from a $50 billion outlay in total. Missouri received the ninth most money out of any state, but less than Kansas and Oklahoma. Why did we get less than Kansas and Oklahoma, two states that admittingly I have familial ties to? My mom lived in Overland Park for a while. My grandma's from Ponca City, Oklahoma, so I do like those states. But is it just because they had more rural populations than Missouri?
There's a couple of different... I will tell you, there was a scoring algorithm.
I was going to guess that, but I wanted to just make sure that was the case, but continue.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would like to know as well. No, the scoring was done for the funding from each state. Each state had a base of $100 million each. If they, you know, qualified and wrote an appropriate application that CMS approved. And that is, so your baseline funding is $100 million a year. From that, the other kind of pot of money, if you will, was competitive amongst the states. And it was based on your level of rurality. And so that took into account your rural population, but also how isolated is that rural population. You really saw Alaska being way up. I think they might have been number two in funding. And so really more about healthcare access related to how rural
you are. Is this a one-time money, or is it going to be like $216 million or more for a number of years.
This is $216 million over a period every year for 5 years.
Okay.
And so, but with that, we are seeing some of the new types of requirements that are coming from the federal government in that performance and outcomes and reaching your, you know, objectives within your plan year by year are going to determine the amount of funding that may be redistributed amongst states.
So it could be potentially up to $800 or $900 million over that five-year period, but only if you actually achieve the goals in there.
Correct. And on an even more positive note, if you keep doing well and other states aren't doing as well, we can take Kansas and Oklahoma's money.
Oh, that would be amazing. I use the city of Doniphan as a great example, not only because my good friend Caroline Dohack is from there, but I've been to Doniphan, and that is a place that used to have a hospital that no longer has one, and healthcare is not as present as it was there 10, 20 years ago, causing people to say, move to Poplar Bluff or move to Cape Girardeau where there are hospitals. So how would this money help cities like Doniphan or others that don't have as robust access to healthcare that they did 10, 20 years ago?
Missouri has had close to a dozen hospitals close over the past recent history. And being from a rural area myself, you know, I grew up in, most people don't know it, it's Drake, Missouri. And I was born in a hospital in Washington, Missouri, which is an hour away. And that was the closest hospital. So I think that when we're thinking about health outcomes, you really can't compare one. Rural is rural, but rural areas have very different unique needs, very different unique health systems, and how those health systems work together. So what's great about the Missouri Rural Health Transformation Plan is that it's really built on a local kind of a hub and spoke model of local communities having the ability to identify what are their needs in order to make improvements, and how do they better serve the individuals within their communities and get better health care outcomes. So what partners in their local community do they need to work with for doing nutrition education that might go along with a GLP-1 for weight loss and, you know, physical activity? Those things that healthcare may not pay for, but when we see healthcare start to pay for them, we can demonstrate the value that it brings in lowering the overall cost of healthcare. We can get people back to work and being productive and healthy in their lives. And that's really the impetus of this. And when I talked about earlier moving to alternative payment arrangements in Medicaid, rural health transformation funding, you see the backbone of Missouri transitioning to value-based payment for our healthcare providers within the plan. There's the digital infrastructure as well as the actual building of the payments.
And I think that the other thing, and this is a broader criticism of the Rural Transformation Fund, is that, yes, it's good and nobody's criticizing it, but it was kind of brought in as kind of this compromise because the medical provider tax is going to be cut potentially in the future. So how do you make sure that this money is maximized when a whole bunch of other money going into Medicaid could potentially be cut in the future if Congress doesn't reverse those medical provider tax cuts? I understand a lot of hypotheticals and what ifs there, but I feel like that has been the major criticism.
I think it's a very, you know, a question a lot of people have. So I'm glad that you asked it. I think with this, with the Big Beautiful Bill, a lot of the reporting and the media coverage, particularly on the Rural Hospital Fund, was early on in this becoming like a negotiation point, or and then there wasn't a lot of reporting after the final bill passed about what that specific language was that was finalized by Congress in the bill. And when you look at that specific language, it really is not it's not the same message that was originally kind of the what you talked about, replacing a loss for healthcare providers because of a potential future tax cut.
That was Department of Social Services Director Jessica Bax talking about her first year on the job. We need to take a quick break, but when we return, we'll discuss how BACS is taking on the challenge of overhauling the state's children's division. This is the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. I'm Jason Rosenbaum. As mentioned before the break, the Department of Social Services is responsible for overseeing Missouri's Medicaid program, as well as SNAP and TANF benefits. But it's also in charge of Missouri's Children's Division, which, among other things, manages the state's foster care system and investigates child abuse and neglect. Over the past several years, St. Louis Public Radio reported on a host of alarming problems within the agency. That includes huge unfinished case backlogs, as well as turnover and recruitment struggles in St. Louis. And in some cases, Children's Division personnel failed to prevent fatalities, including when children ingested fentanyl from their parents. In this part of my conversation with Department of Social Services Director Jessica Backs, recorded in her office earlier this week, we discussed how she and Children's Division Director Sarah Smith are trying to keep the agency on track. And she also talked about how she's addressing something that many child welfare advocates believe as the center of the Children's Division's chronic problems: salaries that are too low to recruit or retain investigators tasked with keeping kids safe.
What has DSS done to make this agency function better? I'm not maligning the people that work at Children's Division. They have the hardest job in state government. And as we'll talk about, I think they're often doing this job for pay that is not competitive. But it is pretty clear that Children's Division has not been working for the past few years. And I feel like that is like your biggest challenge as DSS director, is to make this a trusted functional agency again. Understand that's a general question. We'll drill into more specifics in a second, but I want you to address that.
You're right. There's a lot of challenges and serious issues, things that keep you up at night about Children's Division. And coming into the role, talking with Governor Kehoe about understanding the pain points within Children's Division and really how do you approach that, because it is a very large function that has a very just vital impact, the safety of Missouri's children. So one of the things that I first needed to do was find someone who truly understood child welfare. I have a lot of experience in working through government and how to apply that, but I really needed Sarah to come in and bring her perspective. So identifying where do staff need support, because you've got to kind of get to that root cause analysis again of where's the breakdown. And when you have high turnover, part of it's salary, but you've got to think what's in your control. And nobody's going there to get rich and taking that job to get rich. So how do we make sure they feel supported in their role? And that's why we've been focusing on things like we had a manual that is, I would say, was more philosophical than practical. So working over the past year to turn that into practical guidance that staff understand kind of step by step, how to do a risk assessment, where to turn to for questions. That's in motion. We're working on enhanced training. We've acquired some great technology that is basically virtual reality goggles that allow staff to, when they're new, experience
the different scenarios that you might encounter as a children's division worker and kind of practice and work through those. And then one of the other things that I think has been really important is how much Sarah and her leadership team have been out to, I think they've been to every circuit at this point, because child welfare is a system. It's not just children's division. It is the court system. It is the juvenile office system. It is law enforcement. It is all of the providers within the network. And so it's the foster families. So one of the things that they needed to do was go visit in person and understand where is the breakdown here locally, because there are systemic issues, but there are also issues that are maybe more locally driven.
Well, here's one of the biggest systemic philosophical things I've encountered. And it kind of goes in with training, but it also is about philosophy. So whenever I write about children's division, I often get messages from just ordinary people from two wildly different perspectives. The first is from parents who've had children placed in foster care. They sincerely believe children's division was wrong in removing their kids, and they think the system is too strict. And the other perspective is from advocates and parents who know abuse or neglect is going on, but staffing levels for investigators is just too low, or investigators missed obvious signs. That is an extraordinarily difficult needle to thread between being fair to people that may be dealing with poverty and not intentional neglect or abuse, and people who are abusing or neglecting their kids and getting away with it. How do you thread that needle?
I think if you look around the nation, you would see the exact same dichotomy of responses to child welfare within those states. And when you're approaching those decisions, it is a, you know, oftentimes when we go into a home, there is a level of training about what are you looking at, but there is, are you making sure to kind of check all of the boxes? Did you maybe call collateral contacts and find out more about who's in this child's life? But what's, you know, what's a risk and what's an actual safety threat and what's a risk that can be managed? A lot of times how we can manage risk and help provide support and resources for families for a child to be safe is dependent upon local resources or statewide program resources that aren't available, that are larger programs. They're larger problems than children's division itself. Housing, mental health, those are things where if those supports aren't in place, sometimes, so we're really working with our team members to understand that a, you know, mitigating risk, you may have a plan, but if the resources aren't there for that plan, you have to, you know, really come up with a different plan.
You mentioned pay. And I know that you cannot just wave a magic wand and pay all of your employees more money. That is the responsibility of the legislature and to some extent the governor. I asked Governor Kehoe about increasing the starting pay for child abuse investigators, which for context, for a starting salary, it's around $45,000, $46,000. If you've been here longer, you obviously make more. And the problem with that is, you're right, you're not meant to... Child abuse investigators don't do that to get rich, but $45,000 is not competitive with Illinois. Illinois makes a starting salary $71,000. And there are other private sector jobs which pay a lot more. And I think that's responsible for the high turnover, because this is an extraordinarily difficult job that can be very traumatic for people. And if people have another opportunity to go somewhere else to make more money for less trauma or, you know, whatever.
Not 24 hours on call, all of those things.
So I asked him that, and he said that, you know, we should see some action on that pretty quickly. That was in May. It's January. I wanted to give some time to pass before talking with you. I am interested about what, if anything, you're going to do on that, or what you can do without the legislature specifically giving you more money to raise that starting salary.
Yeah. The time of service pay that happened was really, really critical for our team members. And for context, the time of service is retention pay plan that was passed, recommended by the governor, passed by the legislature. And you said, mentioned in your comments that, you know, if you've been here longer, you make more. That wasn't true before this, because there was a 17-year period, I believe, with no cost of living increases for state employees. And so you had someone who had been here almost 20 years who was making as much as someone who walked in on day one.
Yeah. And just again, not to interrupt, when I say 45,000 and I say how low it is, the other context is 5, 6, 7 years ago, the starting salary was $34,000 or $35,000. So it has gone up. And I don't want to say that that hasn't been significant, but continue.
Yeah, no, huge investment from the legislature and from Governor Parson in the state workforce, and then continued by Governor Kehoe. And he really kind of took it to that next step of a pain point with the increases was, if you had, there wasn't any incentive to stay and become an experienced worker who could mentor your fellow workers. And so that added to being a tough job. So some of the things that we're looking at doing is, how can, without a specific dollar increase from the General Assembly, is thinking about the work in terms of, what are some elevated roles that are really necessary within Children's Division to help out the frontline worker? So do you need frontline workers to have a, an extremely low caseload to be successful? Or can that caseload be just a little bit more on average if they had a consultation team who had a lot of experience in maybe children with complex medical conditions, or children who, unique safety situations, drug use. And so if they had an on-call expert, I really think, and those are jobs that, would become a career ladder and really incentivize someone to stay.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. That seems to be like a good solution. Instead of waiting for the legislature. So you start out as starting salary of $46,000. You work there a couple year. You get promoted to one of these consultation that's very specific. And maybe you get 57, 58. I'm just throwing out these numbers. That becomes the incentive for people to stay and keep doing the job and getting paid more money.
Absolutely.
Not as much as the private sector, no. But that seems to be like a functional thing that could really hit at that problem. How soon do you think that that can be implemented? Is that being implemented now?
That's being implemented now.
That was Jessica Bax, the director of the Missouri Department of Social Services, talking with me earlier this week in her office in Jefferson City.
Today's episode was produced by Jason Rosenbaum.
Our audio engineer is Aaron Doerr. This podcast was mixed and edited by Aaron.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.